So I have printed what I need printed. Oh, I can hardly see what I'm doing. Here we go. To make the screen sort of nicer for the public, I have to turn off, I mean, I have to close windows and things, but then I can't see what I'm doing. Okay. I have a note that we are live, but I have not called the meeting to order yet. So does that mean the audio is not being broadcast yet? Until I call us. I'm ready to start the meeting.
Manny, we can't see the blue light, so we just need some indication when it's turned on.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm convening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Wednesday, January 27th. We have one item on the agenda today. It's an informational meeting. First, let's call the roll.
Representative Hernandez.
Present and on video.
Representative Levy.
Present and on video.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh is here on video.
Representative Smith.
Yep, Representative Smith is here on video.
Vice Chair Pham.
Present via video.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke present via video.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Present by video. All here. Thank you. Mr. Alanak, would you please present this agenda item?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is the, I think, final major overview for tax issues as the committee gets underway for this session. And we're switching from income tax, we're going to move over to the property tax. And Jamie McGovern is the economist who handles property tax in the office. So she has a slide deck that she's going to go through with you. She's going to share her screen and go through this overview for you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Jamie McGovern, the property tax economist for the Legislative Revenue Office. I have a presentation for you. I just want to say, if you have an earlier version of the presentation, just a little bit ago, I fixed a couple typos and some font issues. So the current one that's up there is the one that I'm going to be using, but there's no major content difference if you have like an older version printed out. So I also mentioned to Chair Nathanson, I'm working on sharing my screen right now, and then you can let me know, I think, when you can see it.
We can see it.
Wonderful. Thank you. And that I can't see hands. I have one screen, and I think I'm trying to get rid of Chris. Chair Nathanson will notify me if there are questions, and then we'll go from there. So this is just an overview or an intro of the property tax system in Oregon, and I will note that several of the members have been here long enough that you've seen some of this information before. I think I did a similar property tax orientation in 2018. Some things are new, and I'll also note that some good references are each year we put out a basic facts, and there's a section on property tax in there. So some of the tables or some of the graphs that you'll see in here will come from that, from this most recent property tax year's data. And then there's also the property tax statistics book, which is put out by the Department of Revenue. And a lot of our data is taken from there as well. And that's super helpful. It's a little bit more of a deep dive for technocrats and people that are really interested in that math sort of stuff. So I'll just say that to get started, the property tax system is in one sense really simple, because a lot of people know that in Oregon, the property tax bill may go up by about 3% per year, or their taxes go up by about 3% per year. That can be different depending on a few things that we'll talk about here. But on the other hand, the like mechanizations behind the calculation of that number, or something that arrives at similar to that number, is sort of layered and complex. And so we'll get into a little bit of that here. This slide is a bit of the numbers that came in for the most recent property tax year. We have an assessed value, and some of these terminology points we'll get into during the slide, but in Oregon, your taxes, your property taxes are based on a specific type of value called the assessed value. That's different than your real market value. And that this year, the total value of property in Oregon, the assessed value is $440 billion. And that's different. And you can see a little bit more than half of what we call the Measure 5 value, or what most people think of as the real market value. It's not exactly the real market value for all properties. We have things like forest land that are valued a little bit differently in Oregon. But for most properties, the Measure 5 value is the real market value. So the property tax that you are assessed is not assessed on your real market or Measure 5 value. That's the sort of a sale value of your house. And then I'll just point out that through all the property tax and value in Oregon, there's a lot of property that's exempt. And some of that is partially exempt, and some of that is exempted in whole. And so there's a big difference between the real market value that's exempted, which is $174 billion, and the assessed value that's exempted. And in part, that's because there are properties that are fully exempted. You might think of like state buildings or government buildings. And if those are fully exempted, they might not, things that are fully exempted might not even be on the roll as an assessed value to be exempted. Whereas things that are partially exempted, properties that are partially exempted, so you could think of something like business personal property, below $18,500, that would be partially exempted. So you might have, you know, $30,000 worth of property, but only part of that would be exempted. And so the assessed value that's exempted is about $18 billion. And so on that assessed value, the imposed tax is $7.2 billion. And the word imposed means that's the tax that individuals are actually going to get charged on their property. That's a little different, and we'll talk about it, than what was originally maybe calculated. So the tax that's extended to that property is what's calculated, but then that gets compressed. And so in Oregon, this most recent tax year is just a little above 2%, that statewide compression. And I'll say that that's statewide, but it does vary from county to county, and it varies from taxing district to taxing district. And it's actually individual properties and the different types of school districts also see different levels of compression. School districts see more compression than some other government districts. There's urban renewal revenue of $306 million. And the uncollected tax that we have here of 1.8% is slightly unrelated to the other numbers. It's not the calculated tax that's due for the coming property tax year, but the property tax that was due the previous year and was not collected. And so that number is just below 2%.
Thank you. So, we have a question, Rep. Pham.
I apologize. I was just speaking on mute. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I just had a quick clarifying question. Could you explain what statewide compression means?
Thank you, Representative Pham, Madam Chair. We'll get into the compression and the mechanics of it a little bit later in the slide, but essentially there's a cap on taxes that can be collected on any particular property. And if the calculated tax rises above that amount, the tax gets reduced. And so that reduction is what we call compression. And how that compression is done, we'll see a little bit in later slides. Okay, so this is just a little bit of the, Sorry about that. Okay, so this is just a little bit of the, you know, the question of, okay, where is all that property sitting in Oregon and what taxes are being imposed on that? And so we have different classes of property, and we think of residential and commercial property, but there's lots of other types of property. And so the blue bar is what we call the assessed value of property. Now that's the value of your property that your taxes get calculated and then imposed on. And then on top of that, the green bar is the total tax imposed. And so you can see that basically those two things are in alignment with each other. And this is implicitly because of the design of our property tax system. The reason they're not exactly aligned is in large part because there are some property tax exemptions and programs that exist in Oregon so that, you know, you may have a piece of property that has value, but you may not pay taxes on it or something like that. And then the entire sort of share is split up amongst all the members of the class for those property taxes. Okay, and I'm just gonna pop in here with the a little bit of a definitional break here. Oregon operates on a rate system for the most part, and we used to have a levy system. So I kind of wanted to mention the difference between these two types of systems. And I like to think of the levy system as a bit of a top-down system so that the budget or the cost of operation is determined ahead of time. And then that is sort of sliced up, that pie, the cost of operation or the budget for maybe a certain local government would be sliced up and divvied out or allocated to the individuals that own property in that particular taxing district or area. And so, for instance, if that government body decided that their budget was increasing by 20% that year, a lot of the individuals that own property under that jurisdiction, they would see their property tax bills increasing by 20%. And so that's a kind of system that we used to have in Oregon. And now what happens in the rate system in Oregon is that there's specific rate, and we'll talk about the different rates, but there's specific rates that are applied to the value that your property is assessed at. And then that once you have the rate times the base, which is your assessed value, there's a certain dollar amount that's determined. And when you add up all those dollar amounts for the individuals and the property that are owned in that within that taxing jurisdiction or that area, then that determines the amount of money that the local government can use to operate. And so they kind of move in opposite directions a little bit. And I'll note that we still kind of have a little bit of the levy system in Oregon. So most of our rates are these permanent rates or local options, and we'll talk about those. But bonds, once they are passed, there's a set amount of money that needs to be paid back. And so because that money needs to be paid back, they still kind of function as a levy, and the cost of the bond gets allocated amongst the taxpayers. Okay, so you may know in Oregon that the majority of our property tax system is built up off of Measure 5 and Measure 50. And in 1990 in Oregon, as a ballot measure, we passed Measure 5, and in 1997, Measure 50. So one of the key components of Measure 5 and Measure 50 is that they are now enshrined in the Constitution. And so they form the basis of our property tax system. And at the time that Measure 5 was passed, we did not have an assessed value system. We had real market value that our property taxes were based on. And so the language of Measure 5 that was passed in 1990 says that there needs to be a cap on the amount of taxes per $1,000 of real market value of the property. And it specified two different caps, $5 for education related taxes and $10 for non-education or other government related taxes. So we kind of have these like school and non-school tax revenues that we think of in Oregon. And so it capped our levy-based system at the time. And then moving forward a little bit in 1997, we made further modifications to our property tax system. And this is the point where Oregon created this assessed value system. And so you can see on the graph here that at this point, this is where we have this new line that's created, and it really starts exactly at that same point. And what happened there was that we created an assessed value in 1997. We took the previous year's property tax value, took a slight discount of 10%. So you immediately get two discounts and set that from the previous year's value, and you set that as the new assessed value. So you have 90% of the previous year's taxable value and set that as the assessed value for that property. And this Measure 50 also created a permanent tax rate. And so these taxing authorities, so you can think of like the schools and the fire and the police and city and county and all these government bodies, they now have a permanent authority to tax property in their taxing districts based on this new system. And we'll talk a little bit more about that, what that permanent tax rate means. And this changed us from a levy-based system to a rate-based system. And I'm just going to say that we have this thing now that is created with the Measure 50, which is called the CPR. And this is what is called the changed property ratio. And so this is the ratio countywide for the most part, or yes. Sorry, I was getting feedback for a second. So this is the ratio of the maximum assessed value to the real market value in a county across all properties. And that is just to say that this CPR is an important component of the new system because it establishes the difference or the relationship between the assessed value or how fast the value of your property is increasing and a real market value compared to the property's taxable or assessed value. Okay. And if there aren't any questions, I'll move forward. Okay, I'm just going to mention two key implications of Measure 5 and Measure 50. The fact that those property taxes, or those, our new property tax system under Measure 5 and Measure 50 is in the Constitution means that there's so much structure around our property tax system that is now in the Constitution that all property tax changes as a systematic change must go to voters. So there's lots of property tax exemptions that are created in Oregon through the legislature, but structural change is very difficult to enact through the legislature because of how structurally formed it is in the Constitution. And the change property ratio, which we'll talk about in a little bit, is really instrumental now based on these new Measure 5 and Measure 50, and how much a local district can raise, because that change property ratio is going to determine what the value that is the tax base going forward for these local taxing districts. Okay. And I've mentioned that we call the Measure 5 value stat the sort of real market value, what we think of as the real market value, and that can be a little bit different for properties that are sort of unique like forest land. And then we have some specially assessed properties like farm and forest. And there's lots of mechanics behind these creating the assessed value. And once that's determined, that becomes our taxable assessed value. And I will talk a little bit about how we do that in Oregon. So this slide is a little bit technical, and as I mentioned, it can be really simple to just, and it's completely fine to think of the idea that your property taxes may go up by 3% per year. But what actually happens is there's a maximum assessed value and a real market value. And each year, both of those two things are looked at and they are compared. And so in any given year when life is sort of normal and prices of property or real market values of properties are increasing, then the amount that you're taxed on will be what we call your assessed value. But that is determined by the relationship between your real market value and your maximum assessed value. And so what happens here is, for if you can think of your house, if your house was built in 1950, then back in 1997, when Measure 50 was passed, it was going to be given at that point in time an assessed value. But if your house was built in, say, 2010 or 2015, it didn't exist at the time that Measure 50 was passed. And so those properties are what we call new to roll, and that which means that they are going to be put on the property tax roll for the county assessors at a new value, and that value has to be decided upon. And that is also specified by the Constitution under Measure 50, and the formulation for that includes that change property ratio, which we talked about, the countywide average of the maximum assessed value to the real market value. And so you can see, just this means for all the properties that are built going forward, this CPR, this change property ratio, is really key in determining the amount of value that will be put on the property tax roll for years going forward. And what that means is that if local bodies are interested in raising taxes, the CPR is going to be determining that. I'm pausing for a second because it's a lot of information. Okay, and so I want to talk about this idea of the relationship between RMV and the assessed value, which is determined by the maximum assessed value in RMV, and the question of what happens when RMV is equal to one. Because AMV divided by RMV for a particular property is equal to one. And the reason I say this is because you know, a lot of people might have a $400,000 home and they're only being taxed on, say, $200,000 of that, which feels great. It's really wonderful because you think you're getting a discount. From the taxing authority's perspective, they're not able to tax the full real market value of that property. And so, you know, not to say that this is good or bad, but the question of what does that really mean? And so a lot of times what that means is there hasn't been, if the assessed value, going back, sorry, divided by the real market value, these two different, the relationship between these two numbers, if they're very close, what that means is there hasn't been a lot of growth in the area. And so normally, I hope you can all see these two lines in this graph, the real market value kind of does what it does. And so this is actually a chart of a particular house or property that experienced a downward trend during the recession. And in fact, it lost so much value during the recession. This red line is the real market value, that it dipped below what had been the assessed value, or the blue line, which is the maximum assessed value. So normally, so this, I'm going to say from 2013 on here, this is what we might call normal times. So in normal times, when the economy is growing, your property is being taxed along this blue line. Even though you know that your property may be worth this this real market value on the red line, that's not what your property is being taxed on. But what happens is, as this real market value dips below the maximum assessed value, then these two lines are compared, or the two values are compared. And that is when your new assessed value becomes the lower of these two lines, and so, or the lower of these two values. So you're not going to be taxed on that higher value, which was calculated as the maximum assessed value. You'll be taxed on the lower value. So for your assessed value to be equal to your real market value, what that often means is that there's not a lot of economic growth for that particular property.
Jamie, I'm going to interrupt here for a minute while you take a breath and ask a couple of questions.
Sure.
You said a few moments ago, when there hasn't been a lot of growth, some people may be envisioning you're talking about the city is really growing fast, there's a lot of new subdivisions. Mm-hmm. That's different than growth in value for some other reason. In fact, sometimes when there's not a lot of expansion, physical expansion, prices go up because of supply and demand, because there's a constrained supply. Now, you just started to mention it right before I interrupted you, but could you comment for a minute on the difference between growth and growth in value? And also, as a second point, can you say a little more about how different counties are able to keep up with assessment or reassessment?
Chair Nathanson, you're exactly right. I was speaking to financial growth. I was thinking of the value of property. And it's true that if you have a lot of physical growth and the boundaries are non-constraining, so that the property, the, you know, for instance, area people continue to build outward, say that maybe there isn't a lot of upward pressure on the price of the houses. But maybe in urban cores, or maybe in a specific area when there's a lot of demand and that the property value growth is high, you end up being in situations like here from 2013 on. So you could be in the situation where, you know, your assessed value is down on this line or the lower line because of a recession, but you could also be in this situation where these are close together for long periods of time, just because the value of individual properties has not really taken off. So this is not a graph of the local economy or all the properties put together. It's a graph of one property. And so to your comment, Chair Nathanson, you know, sort of in terms of what kind of revenue different taxing bodies are able to collect and what they are able to assess. I know that there used to be a specified rotation for which county assessors were meant to go out and reassess properties. And I do know, I think that's not a specific rule anymore. I think that a lot of individual counties have set goals or protocol to go out and reassess properties. And also, when new properties are either modified or built, if you have a permitting process, for instance, so and a permit is called on your property, then you will be the county assessor will be sort of triggered to come out and revalue the property. And then we also have talked about a little bit in this committee about the fact that if you're on special assessment or some sort of exemption, sometimes that might be a reason why that your property may be revalued after you leave that. So for instance, if you had special like farm or forest property, and then you left that program, or you, you know, sold that and somebody developed on it, then that property might be reassessed. So those are kind of the different ways, all of those things of how the different county assessors are able to keep up with all the changes and the properties that are being built and the values that are changing, that seems to be sort of county specific. And they have their own methods.
Great. Thank you. That's a helpful explanation. I don't want to cause any more digression today, but could LRO please note that I may want to, depending on what bills we have before us and what our discussions might, what direction those might take, I think it might be interesting to hear from Association of Oregon Counties or the County Assessors Association a little more about how they would explain how they keep up with assessment and are some more up to date than others, and just generally what the situation is and also the differences from one to another. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I am taking notes. Okay. So I just thought I'd put in here of example. I tried to cover most of the taxing districts that we think of. I think we're super familiar with things like county, city, school, fire districts, police districts, but there's some other ones, port authorities, water control. And so, you know, if you live in an urban core, you might have 9 different taxing districts that you're paying on. Now that may be offset against the fact that there's more people sharing those costs. And if you live in a more rural district or you don't live near the water, you won't have a port authority. You might only have, say, 4 or 5 taxing districts. So it really depends on where you live and what services you have access to, whether there's a park nearby, you might not have a school. So those kinds of things. And I get really excited when I get to draw pictures, and my mind kind of works in diagrams. And I used to teach and tell my students, if in doubt, draw it out. So I drew some diagrams to try and help other people and the members maybe conceptualize what I'm talking about when I'm thinking about these taxing districts. So there's a lot of terminology in property tax, and I'm sure in the legislature in general. And the two words or terms that I'm going to use here, taxing districts and code areas, are really key to how Oregon does property tax. And the reason it's key is because I'll step back for a second. These taxing districts, so if I take, what I tried to do is take all these shapes and create different taxing districts. And so this blue rectangle is a county, and the gray rectangle is a county, and the gray trapezoid is a city. And then inside of that city, the green rectangle is a school district. And over here, the yellow rectangle is another school district. And then the ovals are fire districts. So you can see these are all sort of layered on top of each other. You don't ever live in one taxing district. You usually live in or you own property in a combination of districts. And if you have a very specific or unique overlapping of taxing districts, that is what's called a code area. And the reason why that's important in Oregon is your property is taxed very similarly to your neighbor's property if you live in the exact same code area. So I'm going to show you or talk for a second about the who lives in different code areas and who lives in the same code areas. So I'll say that, for instance, this red house and this yellow house, they both live in the same county, they both live in the same city, and they both live in the same school district, but they don't live in the same code area because this yellow house sits in a on a piece of property that also has another taxing district. So this one has the county, city, school, and a fire district. And so I'm not saying this is super realistic that there's lots of houses that don't have a fire district, but I'm just making an example that this yellow house and this red house live in two or sit in two separate code areas, even though they sit in several of the same taxing districts. This is the sort of ultimate overlapping of all the taxing districts that a piece of property sits in is by definition the code area. So it's super unique to that set of overlapping taxing districts. And so that's how it's defined. And then you can see that these two houses, the red and the blue house in my diagram or whatever, these are the only two properties or the only two houses that are in the same taxing district. So the red and the green house are in different taxing districts because they're in both, you know, one doesn't have a fire district, but they're also in two separate school districts. So these guys are the only ones that have the same city, the same county, and the same school, and then they have nothing else. So I hope that makes a little bit of sense, because when I think of it like this, then I think of these taxing districts as creating layers in the taxes and the sort of the revenue that's going to go to those taxing districts. And so I personally like to think of these taxing districts as layers in a cake, because this layer of the cake is the total amount of money or revenue that's going to be going to that taxing district. But you individually, as a property owner, don't pay for the whole school district or the whole fire district or the whole city or county or whatever taxing district you're sitting in. But all of these stacked up, if you live in the tax or the code area that has the school, fire, city, and county, all of those together are make up your code area. And then you pay this little slice that depends on your property value. And I'm going to say I've created this cake slice for you that shows you that that's your code area slice, which is going to be your property taxes. And then those $5 and $10 limits come from Measure 5, which say that all of these combined, all of these non-school taxes that you're going to pay, have to add up to $10 or less per $1,000 of your real market value. And then for the school, it's five. So I'm going to pause for a second and say, I am sure that, well, I don't know, but for me, I thought, well, some of you may be saying, but I know that I'm getting taxed $18 per thousand or $17 per thousand. So I know like last year, in our taxing district, it was something like $17.32 per $1,000 of value. But that is on the assessed value of your property. And this cap here is one more layer of Oregon's sort of technicalities and complexities for the property tax system. This cap is actually only on the real market value. So since my assessed value is much lower than my real market value, these caps apply to the real market value, and so they would be sort of inflated if you were thinking of them from your assessed value perspective.
We have a question for you, Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Jamie, mine is just a comment that after sitting through a previous committee where I saw pie chart after pie chart after pie chart, I'm very appreciative to see the equity of the cake chart. So well done.
I'm happy. Thank you so much. Okay, so that was a little diagram and that was fun for me, but I also wanted to give the real world flavor. This is just a tax bill that I pulled off of Google. So it's somebody blanked out the private information and it's public. And essentially what happened is you can see in here all those things I was talking about: Marin County, Soil and Water, Service District for 4-H, Regional Library. Those are all the layers of the cake. And so this is how this creates your total tax bill for this property, which ends up being $4,235 and change. So those are the different layers of the cake that get to your general government, and those would have to fall under the $10 per thousand. And then they also have the school, which would also have to fall under the $5 per thousand. And so those would be the property taxes that come from layering the cake. And this person lives in a code area that looks like it has, you know, 9 or 10 taxing districts.
And Jamie, just because a lot of people are listening to this, not only the committee members, when you say school, please underscore for us which schools we're talking about. It wouldn't include if you happen to have a university in your town like I do, or if you have a community college in your town, and it doesn't, there are some other things. It's not education generally.
Chair Nathanson, I believe that is correct, that universities are not included in the educational taxing districts, but for K through 12 is, and education service districts are, and I believe community colleges are, which are different from universities. So I can check on that to be certain, but there is a bit of a layer cake in the school districts as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so a little bit more on the structure of how we pay. We've had a few questions about the ways that we pay for the services, and thinking about how the taxing districts and government bodies are able to fund. So given that we are not in a levy system anymore, so if you determine a budget, there's no guarantee specifically that you as a government body are going to get that amount of money. And on top of that, in 1997, we established our assessed value system with the permanent rates. And so what we do know is those rates, which are set at a certain amount of dollars per thousand, that are able to be applied to your assessed value, these permanent rates, those are sort of enshrined, and that is a rate that those existing taxing authorities, so taxing districts are services and government bodies that also have the authority to collect tax, they are allowed to issue tax rates based on their permanent rate. But on top of that, so here's my little non-school segment, on top of that, any government body, like say the city or the county, can also have a local option. And so this means essentially that you need to get the permission of the voters to raise their own taxes. And so this is voted in locally. And this is necessary because of the way that our property tax structure is, and that Measure 5 and Measure 50 are in the Constitution, that the legislative body can't just raise, create new taxing districts and raise these taxes for individuals. So they kind of have to vote them in themselves. And then the reason that bonds are a little bit different from local options is because when bonds are approved, there's a specific dollar amount that's approved. And so then, like I mentioned before, that those kind of hark back to those levy systems. And those have a little bit of a different relationship when it comes to compression. And we'll talk about that in Representative Pham's question. And then on top of that, there are some urban renewal programs, which often there are areas of blight or underdeveloped economic areas. And if they are set aside and new value is created as programs are developed to help them thrive, the what's called the excess value that's created by that economic growth is directed towards those urban renewal programs. So they kind of sit aside in their own space in terms of taxes. And then the schools, the urban renewal excess value does not affect the school's permanent rate, local option, and bonds. So that's kind of why they have these two separate pieces. So those are all the different ways that the non-school and school or educational districts can raise money. And I'm just going to talk a little bit about compression because it's come up, and it affects how much money these individual taxing districts can raise. And so I drew a little bit of a, I don't know if I think of this as like filling up a water glass or something, but I think of it like the permanent rate that was set a long time ago back in 1997, this may have been below the $10 per thousand, and that's just fine. But when individuals are able to vote themselves to increase taxes, those local options still are required to meet the threshold of the Measure 5 $10. So you can't vote yourself so many taxes that you breach that $10. And so I'm looking here at the non-school. But then I give another example, and it's not different because it's a school. It's just different because I'm creating a slightly different chart with different values. And so if I had the permanent rate and that was imposed and that was constitutionally required to be below $5, the real market value, and then we also approved additional funding through voter local options, that's fine. And let's say that was $4. And that's fine. But then we also approved a bond, and that bond raised taxes additionally. Bonds are not subject to compression. And that is, of course, because they have to be paid back because it wasn't a rate that was added to the property tax bill, but a specific dollar amount that was approved by the voters that has to be paid back. And so here we have compression, and here, even though we've breached that $5 constitutional limit in some theoretical sense, since bonds are unrelated, if we look at both the permanent rate and the local option, they still remain below the $5 cap that is set by Measure 5. So maybe now people see why people call property taxes complicated in Oregon. We have. I just thought we'd step back. Oh, yep.
Rep Reschke has his hand up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jamie, thanks for going back to that slide. So in the first water glass with the $10 compression, mm-hmm. would the compression happen on things under the permanent rate or only the local options that have been voted in, or is it a combination of both?
Thank you, Rep. Reschke and Chair Nathanson, for that question. It's a good one. So the permanent rate is set, and if you had multiple local options and multiple taxing districts, those would all be cut proportionally. So say, for instance, if you had, you went, say, $2 over the $10 mark. So you needed to reduce your property taxes by say 20%. Then that cut would be applied to all of the local options that were in that code area and those taxing districts.
Okay. So it doesn't affect things that are necessarily, I guess, funded by the permanent rate, just those additional local options, such as maybe a library or a fire district or those sorts of things.
I believe that's correct. I will check to make sure.
Yeah,
sure. Okay.
I think it would be interesting to, again, we could probably get this information from the Special Districts Association. I would hope they would have some examples to show us where, since a fire district and a park district, and let's say the park district wanted some new programming, the library district wanted to be open more than just 2 days a week. You know, they each had ideas about what they wanted to do. They each went to the voters. They didn't necessarily sit down at a table and make an agreement. They each separately go to the voters. The voters approve these things. Presumably, those special districts explained to the voters, this is what we're going to do. But then, because of compression, if their revenue is reduced 20%, for example, in your example that you told us, then that they have to change from what they promised the voters to, oh, now we can only do this much instead of the rest of it. Is that how it goes?
Chair Nathanson, so this is true. I've also, I can say just in the past, in looking at proposed measures and you know, sort of changes that might come along, I have looked back at how those would affect existing tax districts. So that it is a real thing. I will also note that it's not just special districts. Sometimes it's a police district, but they need more money. It's not a special district that's created with this new local option, but it's just they have a permanent rate and they're adding a local option to
sure.
it. So it's both right. of those kinds of things. Yes.
Right.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, they interact. And that is part of the complication of Oregon's property tax system is you can't just create one specific tax for one group because all of the properties get the same rate. And if those rates trigger a reduction, the reduction comes to sort of cascading equitably down all those local options. Okay. Oh, I'm just going back.
Yeah, just proportional. I would call it proportional reductions.
Yes.
Yeah, and it Absolutely didn't right. matter who got in first and who was last with their request to the voters.
That is correct, Chair Nathanson.
Okay.
So I just thought I would look into a little bit of where these taxing districts get their money, because I know that we look at the tax rates, but I think what you might glean from this is the non-school, so this is general government. What you might glean from the blue bars to the orange bar, and this is the total 100% of the funding for each of the individual 36 counties, what this means is the counties with larger orange bars have voted themselves in a larger additional amount to fund the services that they feel are necessary. Those are non-permanent rates. Some of those are bonds and some of those are local options. But what that tells the story of is the blue bar, which is their permanent rate, turned out not to be sufficient to the services that they were providing or to fund the services that they were providing. And so you can see that throughout Oregon, varying degrees, different counties feel the need to raise more money on top of their permanent rate. And I'll also say that I did something a little bit similar for the schools. So this is education. And the story is similar, but the amounts are a little bit different. So I'm going to flip back real quick to the government. And you can notice that the orange bars for the schools in a lot of the places are significantly larger. That's not universal, but that tells a little bit of the story that a lot of counties that decided to vote in more money in taxes voted those in for their schools more often and as a dollar amount more than they did the general government and proportional to the overall budget. Okay. So are there questions? Okay. So I'm gonna talk a little bit. We're getting close to the end of the presentation, but there is an issue that has sort of popped up over the years, and so I thought I would talk a little bit about the assessed value to real market value and where it is for the different counties. And we talked in the beginning about how much you pay in taxes on your property is based on your assessed value. And that doesn't really bear any specific proportional relationship to the real market value of your property on a systematic basis. Only in the year 1997 were those actually connected from a mathematical perspective. And so the real market value just kind of goes as it does, and the assessed value follows very closely to the 3% line. That can be different for some reasons. But so you can see that there are several counties where the assessed value divided by the real market value, or the assessed is close to one, or the assessed value and the real market value are very close to each other. And we talked a little bit before about what that might mean. That might mean that some of those areas are economically repressed, or they haven't grown much since 1997. Or it could also mean that they're just the values of those properties haven't changed much. In part, Rep. Nathanson pointed out if they have room to grow outward, that there isn't a lot of financial pressure on the particular house in a certain area. So people might just build, and so the property values stay relatively flat. People seem to care about this relationship between assessed market and real market value because if the assessed value and the real market value diverge significantly from each other, the wealth building from the individuals that own the property, they in theory have a wealth that grows with the real market value, and the counties are only able to tax, and the local taxing districts are only able to tax on the real market value, and those can be drastically different. And these are just a little bit of data. And those numbers, or the little graph that I just showed you, is across all the counties. But we just took a little bit of a picture of one county to see what that looks like for the properties in one county. So the fact that, you know, you might have a county that the assessed value to real market value ratio is 0.6, that doesn't mean all the properties are assessed at 60% of their real market value. In this histogram, you can see that there's a lot of properties that are assessed at less than 50% of their real market value. Then there's some properties in this little bump that are assessed at around 65% of their real market value. Very few in Multnomah County are assessed at 100% of their real market value, and very few are assessed at below 10 or 15% of their real market value. And what I'll just say is I guess from an academic perspective or whatever, what is interesting is if you think about a particular property that is built, and we all know that there was a recession in 2008 or starting in 2008, if you had a property that was built in 2007 and it was a tract home in a large development, and the property prices in the real market were growing significantly up until that point, then the relationship between the real market value and the assessed values in that time might have been drastically different. So that relationship, that number might have been 0.6. And when that house is completed and it goes onto the roll and the property tax is determined, that the property itself comes on the roll if the sort of relationship or the number that we're interested in, this change property ratio, is 0.6, then that property would come on the roll, they call it, at 0.6 or 60% of the real market value. Then suddenly the market tumbles, and by chance, you know, maybe the developer finishes the house right next door to that, and the same, you know, almost identical property comes onto the roll, quote unquote, 4 months later. And now real market values have tumbled, and they might look like that other graph that we had where they even go below the previous year's assessed value. And so if that happens, the real market value and the assessed value from the previous year, they might be really close to each other. So that property might come onto the roll at 100% of the real market value. And then those two, that it's almost like the birth of the assessed value for that property for the rest of time. That pinpoint of that value will follow that particular property for the rest of its existence on the tax roll until there's like a demolition or a major modification or something that would trigger a reassessment, as Chair Nathanson noticed. And so I give these examples over here a typical $500,000 house in Multnomah County. And if the ratio that determines that what the value of the property will be when it comes on the roll is 0.6, 0.5, or 0.4, that's really going to determine heavily what the amount of taxes that individual pays in property tax going forward. And that, of course, depends on the property tax rate from the all those taxing districts. But you can see that it affects how much money that the county assessors and the tax collectors are able to collect going forward for all the properties that are built. So that ratio and the relationship is important to the funding of the local government and schools. And I think I've covered that. And so that this is a little bit redundant, this last slide, since we got into some questions earlier. And so that's the end of my presentation.
Representative Ruskey, I see your hand. Jamie, I'd like to ask something though first. Many of the comments this afternoon have been to compare the value of a home. So that's residential property, but we have commercial and industrial properties, yes. And there's real property and there's personal property. Could you, we're going to hear from Representative Reschke, but then after you answer the question or point that he's making, could you talk for a minute about how any of these charts might be different or how the information it relates to different kinds of properties?
Yes, Chair Nathanson, of course.
Representative Reschke, it's your turn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Jamie, I guess my question is, just so I can read this chart in the tax column, am I reading $2.20 per thousand and $1.70 per thousand? Is that what those numbers turn out to be?
Sometimes doing math on the fly is not my best thing, but I think this is $22 per thousand.
22, okay.
And 17. And as I pointed out before, that's on the assessed value. So it's not going to necessarily trigger that $10.05 because that is a number that's capped for the real market value. So just setting that aside for a second, I believe we're talking about $22 per thousand or $17 per thousand.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm, my pleasure. So Chair Nathanson, your question is a good one as well. This I do probably tend to lean towards things like homes because they seem familiar to me and maybe to other people. But one of the interesting things in Oregon is the way that our property tax system is structured, which is different in my research than I've noted from other states. So some other states might have a different rate that businesses pay on business property. We do not. So if you live or you own property in a specific code area that includes certain taxing districts, if I have a house and next door you have a dentist office and we both are in the same county and city taxing district, we will be paying the same rate for those county and city. Now, our values of our property may be different, but the rates are the same. Now, that being said, that is for what you had called, and is true, real property. This is the property and it has an assessed value. And then this changes every year with those graphs that I was, you know, showing all of you. The personal property has has different treatment. So each year businesses file their personal property with the county assessor, and there's an exemption up to $18,500. But when the property that's personal property comes on the roll, so to speak, and it's entered at its full value. So unlike you know, a home or a business that's real property that would come on the roll as the CPR times the real market value, this calculated number, and then that would move forward in time with the trajectory of the 3% increase. The personal property comes on as the book value, and then there's depreciation. So usually that value goes down for personal property instead of up, like real property starts to move in an upward direction. And then I'll just say on top of that, that for the different types of property, there are different types of exemptions. And so we all pay the same rate on the same or on our own assessed values, but there are different exemptions that might change your assessed value. If you're a homeowner, an example of an exemption or a special assessment would be if you owned historic property and you had a historic home and you were in the historic property program. So that's an example of how the amount of value that you pay on as the base might be different than everybody else's, but the rate stays the same. And then if you have a business, there are lots of different types of exemptions that you might have as a business, or a farm has a lot of machinery and equipment that's exempt. So you might not be paying on that. So the base is also different, but the rate would stay the same. Does that help answer your question?
Yes, that's great. I was hoping, that's just what I was hoping for, to give an overview to the committee that there's more to it than just all of this really good explanation and detail you gave us about how we get to the rate that someone pays. There's some other things that come into play. I assume that at a future meeting, if someone is asking a question about tax expenditures, exemptions, reductions, or special assessments, that you'll be able to provide information on if this is the amount that could have been included as revenue, but this is the value of certain tax expenditures, such as the exemptions and special assessments.
Absolutely, Attorney Thinson.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Great minds must think alike, because I was going down the same path as I was raising my hand as you were speaking. I was hoping at some future point we could, as a committee, gain more information on the assessment of special assets, airplanes, cogen facilities, underground natural gas pipelines, food processing plants, et cetera, and how that's done. And in particular, how do we ensure, and I'm looking for an education on this, but how do we ensure the state of Oregon is collecting the appropriate amount of revenue based upon assets that logical people could disagree on its value? Mm-hmm. The best example for me, say, is a cogen facility that, because of excessive depreciation, has on a balance sheet been discounted significantly. But for all points and purposes, we know it has significant value. And so today's probably not the time for this conversation, but I would hope that we could have that conversation. I know for District 57, it's a major issue. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for raising that point, Representative Smith. And just looking at all the bills that have been assigned to our committee so far and the types of topics we'll be covering, there will be a time where it seems like the logical and appropriate time to have some further discussion about that point. So thank awesome. You for thank raising you. It. Committee, what other questions or comments, discussion would you like to have? This has been another really big full session. I don't see a raised hand yet. I'm going to make one comment. Occasionally, I write a note about something that amuses me. Sometimes I come up with a quote of the day, and Ms. McGovern, when you were on slide 8, you said, "This slide is a little bit technical." And I really had to laugh several times because, like when we got to slide 18, I was thinking, and this one is not technical. so much of this is very, very technical, but you've mastered it well and drawn us pictures and presented different kinds of charts and graphs to help explain it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. It is hard to know how much depth that the members want to get into in the intro or orientation, and we're always happy to go deeper. If people are really interested in, for instance, the change property ratio, I glossed over a few terms, but if members want to go deeper, we can always have more orientation. But yeah, it gets a little deep in the weeds.
And there was cake.
Yeah, maybe the rest of the LRO economists would be well advised to slip in a picture of a cake now and then into their presentations.
That would help this representative, yes.
I would second that motion.
Can we have the real cake instead of just the picture?
Any other questions for our economist today? Mr. Alanak, is there anything you'd like to add?
I think the one thought that I would add, bringing it back up to a 30,000 or 100,000 foot level, if that's the right idea, is the issue of equity or fairness is always a big topic within the property tax system. And as the members go back and digest a lot, all this information, I would turn to some of the charts that Jamie included that talk about the AV-RMV ratio. And it shows the spread. Now, those are all property taxes combined, or property types combined. And their charts would be different for different, you know, residential, property, and commercial. And Jamie has all of that and is able to produce those. But if you just think about, say, residential property and the issue of equity or fairness and the issue of that AV to RMV ratio and whether or not the members feel, because it is, fairness is always a judgment call, if that ratio should always be the same across all property types or not. And all the stakeholders I talk to around property tax have their own take on fairness. But the value piece is one. And so you have that AV to RMV ratio. Then you also have the CPR and how this current system, there are certain forces with the way the CPR is calculated and applied to new property where certain growth areas in across the state, there are certain trends that are embedded in the current system. And Jamie touched on some of those. I would put that under the category of getting much more into the weeds. So, I would just suggest the members think about that a little bit as you're going through these slides and digesting some of the information, because it is a lot of detail, and connecting some of those pieces takes a little bit of time to thinking through, I think.
Thank you. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris or Jamie, we heard about personal income tax and corporate excise tax, and Oregon seems to be a very unique animal in how it approaches both of those could we also lump property tax into that? Or are there other states that approach property tax similar to Oregon?
So I think I can take that. I have been looking at how we compare to other states, Rep. Reschke and Chair Nathanson. I can say that in looking at the value that we charge per $1,000 or whatever, like the percentage that we charge on our property, we're in the middle of a lot of Western states. So we may be high when it comes to the assessed value. It looked like we're closer to 2%. But when we look at the real market value, we're closer to 1% because those two things are far apart. In terms of the systems, they really are all over the map. So I think one of the things that I mentioned is unique to Oregon is the way that we have all of the different types of property paying the same rates, depending on where you are. It's just how your value is constructed or decided or determined in Oregon that's different. But in a lot of places, like in Colorado and Hawaii, there are special rates for different classes of property owners. And there's also circuit breakers in other places, which is, you know, if your property tax bill gets too high, and there's a certain income threshold, there's a cap. There are homesteading type of clauses for other states or treatments. It's very layered in other states as well. We have some similarities. A lot of states in the West have a different value. They don't all call it assessed value or all call it the rate that we do, but a lot of them have a different value than the real market value on which is the tax is assessed. So there's some similar and some different. That doesn't probably help
thank
much.
You.
Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I wanted to talk about the inequity in property taxes, particularly east of 82nd Avenue in Portland. You know, our taxes are 3, 4, 5 times as much as those in inner southeast or north or northeast Portland. And, you know, we have a high population of gentrified communities who now pay more in property taxes yet receive less services from those property taxes. And there's that huge, I would say, inequality, but also racial inequity in terms of our property taxes. I think in these types of presentations, I think it would be important to highlight how much inequity there is, particularly in my district. If there's consistent emails I get, it's about how high their property taxes are compared to people that they know who live in Portland who are paying, you know, 4-3 times less than they are. Yet, you know, we have less parks, we have less grocery store. I mean, sorry, that's not paid for by, but we do have less grocery stores, but we have less public services. Yet we contribute more than folks who are higher income. So I just wanted to point that out. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Rep. Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hernandez has brought up an interesting point that probably Multnomah County is probably one of the most diverse counties in our state. And so when we look at county by county, Multnomah is just this, it's very diverse, I would say. And so it's unlike, say, maybe Klamath County or Lake County that I represent, where it's pretty flat, I would guess, on the distribution. But Multnomah County would be interesting to look at. And I guess when we're talking about this, it'd be, we should look at Multnomah County and maybe Washington, I'm not sure, but Multnomah for sure, as kind of its own unique animal in a sense because of the difference in income, the difference of when buildings were put up, etc.
Chair Nathanson?
Yes.
There was a point that I meant to mention and forgot. It's just a technical point, and I thought if it was okay, I would add it.
Yes, certainly. And I think Rep. Pham is going to have a question or comment also. No? Okay.
I was just, Madam Chair, I was just going to add a brief comment that in looking at the county graph with the distributions, it looks like Hood River, as well as Washington County and, let's see, Deschutes counties have also pretty big differentials between their assessed value and the real market value. That's it. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you for noticing that. Yes, Ms. McGovern.
Rep. Pham and Chair Nathanson, I just, we did do a presentation looking at CPRs at one point. And so if there's additional questions on that, as Chris mentioned, like there's more information that we can go into looking at the distribution of those relationships. The only comment I was going to make was a technical one, that which I forgot, which is that one of the difference between bonds and all the other methods of raising revenue for taxes is in the way that I discussed how all properties have an assessed value, but there can be exemptions. So you can be partially exempt or you can be fully exempt. If you have a property that's exempt, that means you're not paying taxes on that value. And what that means, because we're a rate-based system and not a levy-based system, is that money does not get collected. Sort of period, like for the permanent rate or the local options. However, what it means for bonds, because the bonds are the sort of legacy levy system that we have, is that money that you would have been paying on that property, if you get an exemption for your property, that money still has to be collected. And so there's a redistribution of that tax due to the other taxpayers in the area. So there's a slight difference in the way that the taxes and how they're assessed and what type of taxes they are impact the taxing districts versus the individuals. So for instance, in the case of the permanent rates and the local options, there's a revenue loss. In the case of the bonds, you see in our revenue impact statements, there's a revenue shift that is shifted, that tax burden is shifted to other taxpayers, but there's no loss. And that was all.
I appreciate your adding that point, and that's something that I hope you will remind us of as we consider, if we have hearings on bills related to property tax exemptions.
Absolutely.
It's not just about the overall amount of revenue that's impacted, but also this, it's about the shift then as it relates to bonds. So thank you.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions this afternoon? We have come to the end of this agenda item. I'd like to mention before I adjourn that we have had several days in a row of information meetings. Instead of 2 weeks of just briefing after briefing after briefing, we've had a really good set of meetings to get us grounded in the fundamentals of these really big, important areas. But there are other types of taxes that this committee hears about and considers. We just didn't get an information briefing on all of them. We didn't do there are many, many of them, a few big and many smaller ones. We will cover those at in the future in advance of hearing any bills that might relate to, for example, the gas tax or the marijuana tax. So if we're going to be hearing bills on the topics, we will have an informational meeting and get a briefing, an overview like we have on these big areas. So it wasn't that we forgot about them. We just are intentionally spreading out this type of information. And who knows, there may be something that we don't have a hearing about, so we didn't need a briefing about it. Mr. Alanak, is there anything else to cover before we adjourn for the day?
I think you have exhausted your agenda, as it were. And then tomorrow you start in on a couple of public, you do have an informational tomorrow. It's kind of a unique circumstance. And then two public hearings.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. See you tomorrow. We're adjourned.